KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If all of the tariffs are imposed, it would be a tax increase of more than $800 per household in 2025.
President Trump is using tariffs to pressure other countries. How might people here in the U.S. feel it?
For Wednesday, February 5th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In his first weeks in office, President Trump has invited millions of federal workers to resign and outright fired others.
Not all are going quietly.
My position on DEI and the permissibility of it make me unfit to serve.
Also, there's an experimental treatment that could help people who live with a paralyzing genetic disorder.
And after some days, my legs just felt supercharged. It's like, man, I feel like I can walk a mile.
And a look at what's behind the Trump administration's focus on what it calls, quote, gender ideology.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Europe has completely rejected President Trump's proposal to take over Gaza. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Europeans reiterated their support for a two-state solution.
President Trump's proposal to take over Gaza and displace 2 million Palestinians so America can rebuild the devastated enclave has been met in Europe with disbelief and criticism. Germany's foreign minister Annalena Baerbock said an expulsion of the Palestinian population would lead to new suffering and new hatred. The French foreign ministry said the forced transfer of Palestinians to enable the American supervision of Gaza would, quote, constitute a serious violation of international law. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said Gazans must be allowed home and allowed to rebuild. Starmer said the most important thing is sustaining the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. That issue was not even evoked amidst the controversy. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
West Point is disbanding a number of clubs for cadets related to race and gender. In a memo, the military academy says the decision was made in accordance with President Trump's executive order and Defense Department guidance. Steve Walsh reports.
The memo dated February 4th disbanded 12 clubs, including the Native American Heritage Forum, the Asian Pacific Forum, the National Society of Black Engineers, and the National Society of Women Engineers. It goes on to say the clubs were barred from using government time, resources, or facilities to continue informal activities. In a statement, West Point says the clubs were disbanded because they were sponsored by the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, which was disbanded last summer. The military academy says cadets can still participate in those groups during their off-duty time. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
As a deadline looms tomorrow for federal workers to decide whether or not they want to accept an offer from the Trump administration to resign from their jobs early, some workers are expressing fears they could be fired if they say no. Federal workers' unions are telling their members to say no, though, saying the fact the offer may not be legal, according to them. A UCLA report finds the L.A. area wildfires have caused $95 to $164 billion in damage. Cap Radio's Manolo Sakaira has more.
So far, the Eaton and Palisades fires have resulted in the loss of over 16,000 homes and other structures. Julian Lee is an economist with UCLA's Anderson School of Management and a co-author of the report. She says this could be California's most expensive series of wildfires to date, in large part because of where they happened.
We see that the median home price in these two recent fires is much higher than previous ones. That may cause more loss.
She says the damage could also cause a loss of $4.6 billion for Los Angeles County's GDP for 2025.
You're listening to NPR. Another exchange of prisoners took place between Ukraine and Russia today. NPR's Hannah Palmarenko reports from Kyiv that with the support of the United Arab Emirates, 150 Ukrainian soldiers have returned home.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky posted a video from the first minutes of the meeting of the exchanged Ukrainian soldiers. In his evening address, Zelensky commented on the exchange, calling it a happy day. He added that some of the soldiers had been in captivity for more than 2 years. It is very, very difficult to return our people, but we are doing it, and we will continue to do it. We have to return everyone, he said. This was the 61st prisoner exchange since the beginning of the Russian full-scale invasion. In total, more than 4,000 Ukrainians have been returned from Russian captivity. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
Well, not necessarily as pricey as last year's game. It is still going to cost you quite a bit of money if you want tickets to this Sunday's Super Bowl game between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles in New Orleans. The average price for a ticket as of this week totaling just over $6,500. If that holds, it would be the third highest ticket price per game. On the site TickPick, average prices for last year's game between the Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers topped $9,100 apiece. Crude oil futures prices fell lower today. Oil dropped more than 2% to $71.03 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump is using tariffs or the threat of them to pressure other countries. So what does it mean for you? Trump has now imposed a 10% tariff on Chinese goods, and he's still threatening a 25% tariff on goods from Canada and Mexico, though that is on hold for about a month. When tariffs like these take effect, it is Americans who pay higher prices. NPR's personal finance correspondent Laurel Wamsley is here to talk us through it. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Laurel, for starters, we have been hearing about these tariffs for quite a while, and now they are happening, at least in part. So tell us, how much are Americans going to feel it?
It's going to be significant. I mean, every day, lots of us in the U.S. use phones made in China, eat fruit grown in Mexico, and live in homes built from Canadian lumber. Now, all of that could get a lot more expensive. Tariffs are a tax on goods imported from abroad, and that's a tax paid by Americans in one way or another. Erica York at the Tax Foundation told me that the potential blow to Americans' wallets is big.
We found that on average, if all of the tariffs are imposed, it would be a tax increase of more than $800 per household in 2025.
Now, the bulk of that would come from the hefty 25% tariffs proposed on imports from Canada and Mexico. But about a fifth of that estimated $800 is from the tariffs now in effect on Chinese goods.
Tell us what kind of goods from China we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's a whole range of things. It's consumer goods like footwear, clothing, toys, electronics. American businesses also import a lot of the stuff they need from China too, like machinery and components for their own products. So the tariffs mean building things in the U.S. will get more expensive too. And the tariffs are broader this time than they were in Trump's first term. For example, there's no exception for Apple this time. And they would end an exception long enjoyed by companies like Temu and Shein to ship cheap goods directly to consumers. And China has announced that it's retaliating with its own tariffs on certain American exports, which will hurt Americans' finances too.
Laurel, as we mentioned earlier, President Trump has put his tariffs on Canada and Mexico on hold for now. But if they do happen, how will those tariffs affect Americans?
Well, almost two-thirds of our vegetable imports come from Mexico, and about half of our fruit and tree nuts. We're talking tomatoes, raspberries, bell peppers, strawberries, and of course, avocados. 90% of the avocados we eat in the U.S. were grown in Mexico. So if there ends up being a tariff on imports from Mexico, your grocery bill and guacamole surcharge are about to get bigger. The tariffs would likely increase the cost of building materials too, like lumber from Canada. And that's not great amid a housing shortage when it's already expensive to build in the U.S.
A lot of people might be wondering about bigger ticket items, like cars, for example.
Yeah, car making is highly integrated between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. That means that parts are crisscrossing the borders before the car finally rolls off the assembly line in one of the countries. Right now, we don't have to care that a Toyota Tacoma is produced in Mexico. But with a 25% tariff, it could mean a big price hike. And gas, too, could get more expensive since we import a lot of oil from Canada.
Is there anything that consumers can do to avoid this hit?
Not much, unfortunately. These are pretty sweeping tariffs if they all go through, affecting goods from the three countries from which we import the most. And even trying to buy American may not help very much because U.S. producers will probably raise their prices to nearly match their competitors. As York at the Tax Foundation told me, there's no winning a trade war.
NPR's Laurel Walmsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
In the first major Israeli-Arab war in 1948, many Palestinians were driven from their homes and sought shelter in Gaza. The direct descendants of those refugees make up most of Gaza's population today. So President Trump struck an extremely sensitive nerve when he called for uprooting all Palestinians in Gaza. NPR's Greg Myrie has made dozens of reporting trips to Gaza over the years. He joins me now from Damascus, Syria. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Just walk us back in the history and explain in a little more detail why so many Palestinian refugees came to be concentrated in this tiny strip, the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, the 1948 war was really the critical moment. Israel had just declared statehood and was immediately at war with several Arab countries, as well as the Palestinians, who didn't have a state then or now. Hundreds of thousands of civilians fled or were driven from their homes, and many are Palestinians who went to Gaza. So now you have this large refugee population, and the very young new United Nations sets up a refugee agency just for the Palestinians, which helps the Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the West Bank, and neighboring countries. This same arrangement has remained in place to this day, and the descendants of those original refugees are still classified as refugees, even if they were born in Gaza and have lived there all their lives.
Understanding that there's, of course, a range of views, if Palestinians in Gaza had their choice, how would they like to see this resolved?
Certainly the dream for many has been to return to their former homes, which are now inside Israel's internationally recognized borders. In Gaza and other areas, Palestinians will often show you around their homes, and they'll proudly display these large, oversized rusting keys and yellowing land deed documents to those former family homes. But Israel's always rejected a large-scale return of Palestinian refugees, saying it would be swamped demographically. And during periodic peace talks over the years, the focus has been on making Gaza part of a Palestinian state that would also include the West Bank and a capital in East Jerusalem.
So when President Trump comes along and says Palestinians in Gaza should be uprooted because the U.S. is going to take over, I mean, based on your experience, is there any reason to think some Palestinians would be willing to leave Gaza?
Palestinians in general, and the refugees in particular, harbor this deep fear of being displaced ever since the trauma of 1948, which they call the Nakba or the catastrophe. And Trump's comments really struck that chord. It's just hard to see how you'd ever get past such a core emotional issue. We've just seen more than 15 months of a devastating war in Gaza, and very few Palestinians left during that time. A couple reasons for this. First, they really couldn't. Israel blocked its borders. Egypt, which is sympathetic to the Palestinians, kept its border with Gaza closed except for aid deliveries. You know, a very small number of Palestinians did bribe their way out of Gaza to Egypt at the cost of thousands of dollars, but very few, very little sign that they would want to leave.
And NPR's Greg Myrie in Damascus. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Sure thing, Mary Louise.
An experimental treatment that stimulates the spinal cord may help people with a paralyzing genetic disorder. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study of three people with a rare inherited condition that causes muscles to waste away.
Doug McCullough was 11 when he was diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA, a disorder that kills off motor neurons in the spinal cord. McCullough is in his 50s now and relies on two canes or a wheelchair to get around.
As a person with a progressive disease, you never get any better. You're either maintaining or you're getting worse.
So McCullough had low expectations when he signed up for a 4-week experiment at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Scientists there temporarily implanted wires in his spine. Then, in the lab, they began delivering pulses of electricity to certain nerves.
That first afternoon, they were like, do you feel anything? I'm like, no. And then they'd start turning it up a little bit, and then you'd start feeling this faint pulse inside your body.
Specifically in his legs. And over the course of the experiment, McCullough's legs regained some function. He could walk farther, his gait was better, his legs felt stronger even when the spinal stimulator wasn't connected.
And after some days, my legs just felt supercharged. It's like, man, I feel like I can walk a mile.
Two other volunteers with SMA also improved. The youngest was 20, says Marco Capogrosso, one of the scientists in charge of the experiment.
He improved so much he could walk from the family housing where they were staying for the trial to our lab, and he couldn't do that before.
There are now drugs that can slow or stop the loss of motor neurons in people with SMA, but the treatment doesn't restore the muscle function they've lost. Capogrosso's team had been using spinal stimulation to boost arm strength in stroke patients and thought the approach might work on the leg muscles in people with SMA. In both cases, the idea was to get more out of the relatively small number of nerve cells that remain intact. Capogrosso says the results with SMA patients were remarkable.
Friday, they would come in the lab, do their tests, and then they would go home. Then on Monday, they would be back. We would reassess their strength because they were doing it on a daily basis. And suddenly, they had 20% more strength for the knee extension.
Much of the improvement was maintained even when the stimulator wasn't turned on. Capogrosso thinks that's because stimulation had helped reestablish communication between the remaining motor neurons and other neurons involved in the circuit that allows walking.
They had much less motor neurons left because some of those died, but now they were starting working as normal motor neurons. So this increase in strength that we observed was because their cells were better able at controlling their muscle.
The result, which appears in the journal Nature Medicine, supports an idea proposed in 2011 by George Mentis at Columbia University.
What people thought until that time is that this is really a motor neuron disease. And if you fix the motor neurons, you will be fixing the disease.
But Mentis showed that in mice with SMA, the disease also disrupts connections between motor neurons, which tell a muscle when to contract, and sensory neurons, which monitor what that muscle is doing. Mentis says the results in Pittsburgh suggest that spinal stimulation improves these connections and could make a big difference to people with SMA.
During that month of electrical stimulation, we never reached a plateau. They were still improving. So obviously you will say to me, oh my God, can they improve anymore? The preliminary data says yes.
Mentis says spinal stimulation also might help people with other diseases that affect movement, including ALS and Parkinson's. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump has already moved swiftly to remake the federal government. His administration is inviting millions of federal workers to resign and is outright firing others. What is happening could have a significant impact on the lives of regular people, so some are speaking out. NPR's Andrea Hsu talked to one person who is not going quietly.
Jocelyn Samuels was actually President Trump's pick back in 2020 to fill a Democratic seat on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the independent agency created in 1964 to protect U.S. workers from discrimination. Samuels had heard chatter that Trump might try to remove commissioners before their terms were up, but
I was shocked that it happened to me.
Samuels calls herself a mainstream Democrat. She's done civil rights work in the government dating back to the 1990s. She says her policy views haven't changed, nor did she try to obscure them when she was interviewed by the first Trump administration. And yet last week she was told, "You're out." The reason?
My embrace of radical ideology and my position on DEI and the permissibility of it make me unfit to serve.
Which puzzled her, given Trump found her perfectly acceptable 5 years ago. And so her conclusion?
I think it is the perspectives of this administration that have changed.
And that scares her. The EEOC, she says, plays a critical role protecting the civil rights of tens of millions of people who go to work in America.
A role that individuals simply can't make up by hiring their own lawyers and filing their own lawsuits.
Every year, the EEOC investigates tens of thousands of discrimination claims. It facilitates mediation, even takes employers to court. It's an agency committed to protecting vulnerable workers. But now Samuels fears that could change.
I mean, I do think elections have consequences and new administrations do have different priorities.
It's just this time, what she's seeing is an effort to eviscerate the very nature of the agency's work to bring EEOC policy in line with Trump's broader crackdown on diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. She worries that employers will now roll back decades of work addressing barriers to opportunity. They might stop recruiting from underrepresented communities. They might shut down mentoring opportunities.
Because the administration has offered no description of the kinds of initiatives that it is sweeping into the DEI rubric, employers may be chilled.
Now, the EEOC can't make big policy changes yet, but once Trump appoints a new commissioner, Samuels expects an upheaval. The EEOC currently has guidance that makes clear that trans people are protected from harassment on the basis of gender identity. The agency's Republican chair has repeatedly said that that guidance harms women and ignores, quote, biological reality. Samuels sees it differently. She says the guidance is needed to protect people who experience egregious treatment at work.
Whether it is through misgendering or asking invasive questions about employees' genitalia or calling people it.
After a career of fighting for other people, Samuels is now having to think about herself, whether she wants to challenge her firing in court.
I'm going to be thinking very hard about appropriate next steps.
The Supreme Court ruled 90 years ago that presidents don't have the power to fire commissioners of independent agencies. Samuels doesn't want to become the case that changes that. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Washington.
Today, the National Women's Soccer League agreed to a $5 million settlement over an abuse scandal that has rocked the league. In 2021, players accused coaches and other officials of widespread sexual harassment and emotional abuse. Attorneys general in New York, Illinois, and D.C. then held a joint investigation. Here's New York Attorney General Letitia James speaking today about the investigation.
And these abuses were not isolated incidents. They were systemic, pervasive, and enabled by a league that repeatedly failed to protect its players. Coaches abused their power, players were silenced, and the league turned a blind eye.
So, what does today's settlement mean for one of sports' fastest-growing leagues? To help us answer that question, we're joined now by NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Hi, Becky.
Hey.
Okay, before we get into the details of the settlement, just catch us up on how all of this started.
Yeah, this dates back a long ways. Basically, for years, players said they endured abuse that took a lot of forms, sexual harassment, sexual coercion, coaches who made advances at players or touched them out without consent. There was also emotional abuse, control over food and housing. There was bullying. And coaches have, or at the time, had direct player over players' careers via trade or influence about whether they'd get a coveted call-up to the U.S. Women's National Team. And so players often didn't report it out of fear of retaliation.
Wow. Okay, well, we heard Letitia James there say the league turned a blind eye. What did that look like?
Well, let me tell you about the most prominent case, which was first publicized by The Athletic back in 2021. So a head coach named Paul Riley, two players accused him of regularly making sexual advances on them. He tried to get them to kiss each other. Eventually, one of those players made a formal complaint to team staff at the Portland Thorns, which is where they were all at the time. That team let Riley go, but then he was employed again immediately with another team. He was back in the NWSL coaching in North Carolina when the report came out. He denied the allegations then when that Athletic story came out, but he was fired right away and since been banned for life. But it just shows that the league didn't have appropriate measures in place to prevent this kind of abuse from happening again.
Mm. Okay, well, that's what happened in Riley's case. But part of what prosecutors have focused on is that it went well beyond one single coach, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that report back in 21 sort of broke the dam, and all sorts of other allegations came forward about several other coaches. Two big investigations followed, one by the league and its players union, the other commissioned by the U.S. Soccer Federation. Both concluded that the problems were systemic across the league, where complaints weren't taken seriously. A lot of that has already been addressed, policies enacted. The league and the team sort of cleaned house. Eventually, half of the coaches in the league at the time were let go. Four have been banned for life. Others were suspended, and the league's commissioner resigned.
Okay. Well, besides involving a lot of money, what does this new settlement do exactly?
Yeah, well, so the investigation, you know, by these attorneys general started in D.C., substantiated the claims. But the main thing they focused on was how no victims had yet been compensated for what they experienced. So thus the creation of this $5 million fund, which comes out of league coffers. It allows players to get that compensation without having to file their own lawsuits. They can stay confidential. The settlement also formalized a bunch of these reforms we've been talking about, makes the league accountable to prosecutors, things like having anonymous surveys of players, personnel requirements for HR and mental health professionals in every team, that kind of thing.
And how else have things changed at the National Women's Soccer League since then?
Well, obviously, this scandal was a huge deal, huge blemish on the league, but the trajectory has actually gone up since then, I would say. The league has expanded, added four new teams since then, two more on the deck for 26. Team values are up, attendance is up. Not every problem has been solved, but overall, I would say the league is in a much better place than it was a couple of years ago.
That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has talked about buying or taking Greenland. Not a new thing, because the U.S. has taken advantage of the Danish territory before. You see, during the Cold War, an underground military base was built without Denmark's permission.
It was cold. You know, when you walk, like walking into a freezer.
America's history with Greenland, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Irish poet Padraig O'Tooma sees the world through poetry.
It isn't just about looking at the technique of metaphor, whether there is or isn't rhyme. It's also about saying, oh, that line makes me think of that thing that happened to me yesterday.
We talk with him about his new anthology after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. One day after President Trump proposed taking control of the war-shattered Gaza Strip and redeveloping it, his new defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, said the Pentagon was prepared to look at all options. Hegseth met today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the Pentagon.
We have no greater ally than the state of Israel. We're honored to stand alongside you, stare down many of the same threats that you do. And under President Trump's leadership, just like you, we are totally committed to achieving peace through strength, through standing with Israel on our side, putting America first, and never backing down.
The White House says Trump has not committed to putting U.S. troops in Gaza as part of his proposal. Trump's idea has prompted even some Republicans in Congress to push back. With the exception of Israel, there's been international condemnation of Trump's plan for that U.S. takeover. Many U.S. allies, even some foes, have voiced concern about what it would mean for Palestinians, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
Some of the harshest criticism of Trump's Gaza plans came from Scotland's leader, John Swinney.
I think what he said amounts to ethnic cleansing.
Swinney told the BBC he could have nothing to do with any plans to remove Palestinians from their homeland and urged other politicians not to go along with it either. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer told Parliament there should be a two-state solution, with a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Diplomats from France, Spain, even China and the Kremlin have said the same. Trump initially called for Gaza to be cleaned out and now says the U.S. will own and redevelop Gaza into a Riviera for the world's people, Palestinians included. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Well, stocks finished higher across the board on Wall Street today. This is NPR. The bird flu outbreak and resulting egg shortage have led Waffle House restaurants to charge 50 cents extra for every egg sold at its locations in 25 states. From member station WABE, Marlon Hyde reports customers have mixed reactions.
52-year-old Aaron Allen walks up to a Waffle House in Atlanta.
I'm getting ready to get a two-egg meal.
He just learned about the breakfast restaurant chain's new surcharge.
Egg will get charged double, Emma.
You're going to get charged an extra dollar on that meal.
Oh, for real?
For real.
For egg?
At this Waffle House, some customers say they might take a break from the restaurant. Others were unfazed by the charge. The breakfast chain says it serves approximately 272 million eggs a year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture predicts the price of eggs will rise 20% this year. Waffle House plans to change the surcharge as they monitor prices. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
The U.S. Postal Service is backtracking on plans to block small package shipments from China and Hong Kong, lifting a hold that was imposed a day earlier. That news comes after President Trump ordered a new 10% tariff on all goods imported from China. Beijing retaliated with its own new tariffs on American-made goods. Postal Service says it will no longer exempt small deliveries from China to individual customers, ending a loophole that some e-commerce companies in China had exploited. The Dow gained more than 300 points today. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump signed an executive order today that seeks to ban transgender women from playing sports in schools that receive federal funding. It is one of multiple actions that curb the rights of trans and non-binary Americans. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben explains this focus on what the administration is calling gender ideology.
On Inauguration Day, Donald Trump signed an order aimed at eliminating the idea of a gender identity separate from sex. It rescinds Biden-era policies, changes gender to sex on forms, and calls to end funding for, quote, gender ideology. That phrase became one of Trump's favorite slogans on the campaign trail.
I will take historic action to defeat the toxic poison of gender ideology and reaffirm that God created two genders, male and female.
Now the administration is trying to put a political phrase into practice. Harper Seldon, a senior staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, says the way the administration defines gender ideology is intentionally loose.
This is written in a way that is meant to be broad, but also with a specific goal, which is to push trans and non-binary people out of civic life.
The Trump administration's definition of gender ideology negates the idea that gender identity is separable from sex as they define it. Jay Richards is a senior research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation and believes the phrasing works.
It's not hard to tease out what's meant by the term by actually looking at the effects and the emphases of the executive order itself.
Transgender and non-binary people and their allies have long opposed the phrase gender ideology as it implies a belief system rather than an identity. Here's the ACLU's Seldon again.
If we had an executive order that said the left-handed ideology, people would understand immediately that that was not quite right. Being left-handed is just a natural variation, and same with being transgender.
Nearly 2 million Americans identify as transgender, according to a 2023 survey by KFF and the Washington Post. An administration memo about the order has sparked further confusion. A mental health provider with the VA spoke to NPR anonymously for fear of retaliation. They pointed to a line saying employees whose jobs include, quote, promoting gender ideology should be put on paid leave. The provider said, when we read that, we were like, what does that mean? Is that any of us? Or because of the way our profession looks at gender, is that all of us? They also fear that if policy inhibits mental health care, suicide rates among transgender patients could rise. A White House spokesperson told NPR that they stand by the definition. Trump and his allies have long argued that this is about keeping women and girls safe. Here's the Heritage Foundation's Richards again.
The concern is, especially with children and especially in private women's spaces, and in particular, I think, women's prisons, the categories of gender ideology have started to dissolve the clear distinction between the biological sexes.
He points to instances where women in prison have accused transgender women inmates of abuse, including rape. However, government data has also shown transgender inmates are at a higher risk of sexual victimization. All of this is part of a broader lack of clarity about legal rights. The Supreme Court has ruled that employers cannot fire workers for being transgender, but they have not spelled out further specifics. To Seldon, that lack of clarity gives these orders more power.
I think executive orders like this are giving folks permission to push the limits of what they can do.
A transgender woman working in intelligence for a defense contractor also spoke anonymously for fear of retaliation. She's losing access to her workplace's women's bathroom. But in all the uncertainty, she also fears losing her security clearance and her job. So she's moving into a friend's basement. I don't feel comfortable signing a new lease anywhere, she said. It's very hard to focus and feel motivated to work for a government that seems like it could fire me at any moment. So even as it's unclear what the executive orders will do, the effects are already playing out. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Hoarding disorder affects an estimated 2% of the population. In older adults, the psychiatric illness raises the risk of accidents and social isolation. As Sarah Bowden reports, some are learning to manage it in a group class.
The class in Irwin, Pennsylvania, takes place around tables inside a Masonic lodge. About a dozen people talk about why they want to get their hoarding under control. Some want to have visitors over without embarrassment, or lose fewer things, or simply enjoy their home more. One woman was motivated because she needed some new clothes, so she bought them, but forced herself to keep her new purchases in the car until she donated the same amount of old clothes to a local charity.
Yesterday, mm-hmm. I finally brought my new clothes in.
Nice!
That's awesome.
Yeah.
The woman asked not to be named because she doesn't want people to label her with hoarding disorder. People who hoard admit they don't fully understand why they do it. Another class member, Bernadette, recently found several broken clock radios in her bedroom.
They're done. They're dead. And they were sitting in my drawer, and I'm thinking, Bernadette, why didn't you get rid of them when you knew they were dead?
Bernadette asked that we only use her first name because in the past, people have judged and criticized her for her illness. She says she'll never be perfect, but Bernadette is working to get rid of stuff she doesn't need, like VHS tapes and cookbooks.
And I don't even cook.
Ordering someone with hoarding disorder to clean up their mess is like yelling at someone with astigmatism to just see better. It doesn't work. What causes hoarding isn't well understood by science, but the disorder typically appears when someone's a teenager. And it gets worse with age, partly because people have had decades to acquire stuff.
I certainly have more belongings now than I did when I was 22.
Kira Timpano is a psychologist at the University of Miami. She theorizes that hoarding behaviors intensify due to age-related cognitive changes that regulate impulsivity, judgment, and memory.
It's like, oh, I'll remember this special thing that happened because I have this object. And one of the things that we know with age is that both our trust in our memory and our actual memory abilities do decrease with age.
In extreme cases, homes are so crammed they become a tripping hazard, and falls are particularly dangerous for older people. Older Americans are also at risk for social isolation, and hoarding makes that worse too, says Cassie Kramer of the Massachusetts Hoarding Resource Network.
Kind of not wanting to have people, you know, come into their homes and, you know, for that reason, alienated from family and friends.
Hoarding also increases the risk of fires, insect infestations, and mold, which can all lead to eviction. Kramer has known older people who became homeless as a result of hoarding. Because of this overlap with aging, Timpano warns there is going to be a reckoning.
I get almost as many calls from concerned family members as I do from patients who are seeking help. You know, my loved one, my elderly parent, has this issue with stuff, and I don't know what to do.
And good interventions are scarce. Timpano says one of the best options is attending a class like Bernadette. In addition to learning new skills, Bernadette says she enjoys her new friendships.
I think it makes it easier to have other people that you can talk to, that knows your problems, that understands what's going on with you, that is not going to condemn you.
And her classmates here don't do that. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
This story was reported in partnership with Spotlight PA and KFF Health News. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Dearborn, Michigan has the largest Arab American population in the U.S., and the community turned out in droves for Donald Trump in the presidential election, in anger over U.S. military support for Israel and the deaths of tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza. Now, Trump's comments about the future of Gaza and the Palestinian people are reverberating in the community. Zena Issa of Michigan Public has more in this report.
Dearborn, Michigan is usually a Democratic stronghold, but it saw a seismic shift in voting patterns in the last presidential election. It was driven by one issue, Gaza. Arab Americans here who had long supported Democratic candidates strongly opposed U.S. military support for Israel and wanted an end to the war. They wanted an immediate ceasefire. That wave of anger handed Trump victory in Dearborn, but the president's comments on Tuesday about Gaza are causing concern.
When it comes to Trump's rhetoric, we will call it out and say that is abhorrent, grotesque rhetoric.
Hudhayfa Ahmed was a spokesperson for the Abandon Harris campaign.
However, we're not going to sit here and conflate that rhetoric with the actions of the previous administration.
Ahmed says while Trump's statement is alarming, he still believes electing Kamala Harris would have been worse.
To this day, if Harris-Waltz ticket had won the election, the fact that they lost the election led to a ceasefire. It surprised us. It took us by surprise, but we understand that this was Trump acting in his own self-interest, not necessarily from a humanitarian side.
Local Palestinian artist Janine Yassin shares that perspective and says what's even more disturbing was what happened to Palestinians under the watch of the Biden-Harris administration and after Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee.
She did not really give us the assurance that we needed that she wouldn't allow the Zionists to act with impunity and enact the genocide.
Other Arab American voters in Dearborn say their tax dollars have funded a war in the Middle East they strongly oppose. They call Trump's remarks devastating. Josiah Walker, a University of Michigan student, was among 11 charged for their involvement in the pro-Palestinian encampments on campus. He says Trump voiced support for a two-state solution during his first term.
I'm not surprised by his change of heart at all. I think it's like right in line with what like everyone was expecting.
And Walker says he thinks the U.S. needs to take stronger action against Israel.
You know, the best case scenario is not only achieving a ceasefire, and not only like fully like opening aid routes, but like also applying measures against the Israeli government so that they quite literally can't carry out like even more atrocities.
Walker did not vote for Trump. However, in the aftermath of the president's remarks, the group that once played a key role in Trump's voter outreach to the Arab American community decided to change its name. The group formerly known as Arab Americans for Trump now calls itself Arab Americans for Peace. For NPR News, I'm Zina Issa in Dearborn.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Irish word fila, spelled F-I-L-E, means both poet and seer. Well, for Irish poet Padraig Ó Tuama, seeing the world through poetry is a calling, whether that's his own poetry or someone else's. Several times a week, Ó Tuama walks listeners through poems on his podcast, Poetry Unbound. Now he is out with a new anthology focused on the pain and the pleasure of human connection. It's called 44 Poems on Being with Each Other. Padraig, welcome.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
There are a lot of poems out there about a whole lot of different kinds of relationships. How on earth did you narrow it down to 44?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I had spreadsheets of poetry, which I never thought I'd need to do.
Sounds like an oxymoron to have a spreadsheet of poetry.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I should have done it on parchment or something. That would have made it much more appropriate.
With a quill pen, yeah.
I was curious about how it is that poetry could speak to all kinds of experiences of the human condition. Joyful ones, as you mentioned, you know, the pleasure of being with each other. Painful ones, you know, difficult experiences, grief or shock, the demand to be with yourself as well. And that can be a mixture of all kinds of things. So I suppose I wanted to get poems in many different kind of categories about what it's like to be with somebody else or be with yourself.
Well, let's talk about one of them. One titled Fear and Love by Jim Moore. And first, would you read it to us?
Yeah. Fear and Love by Jim Moore. I wish I could make the argument that a river and a sunset plus a calm disregard of the ego are enough. But whatever comes next must include tents in the parking lot, that homeless camp on the way to the airport, and the hole in your cheek from the cancer removed yesterday. I said last night, in the few seconds before I fell asleep, "You do realize, don't you, everything is falling apart?" You said, "Okay, I'll try to keep that in mind." And now it is starting to be late again, just like every other night for the last 75 years. Fear and love, a friend said in an impromptu speech at a surprise birthday party. We all live caught between fear and love. He tried to smile as he spoke, then sat down. Yesterday, you saw the moon from the operating table where they were about to cut you. Look, you demanded, and the surgeon bent and turned to see it from your angle, knife in hand.
Mm. So much in that one. Why does this poem stick with you?
Oh, I love it. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons on every line that I love it, but that's that final part. Look, you demanded. And then the surgeon being the one to obey the person upon whom the surgeon's about to do some surgery. The surgeon bent and turned to see it from your angle. Part of me thinks that one of the levels of this poem is thinking about the ways that we can affect each other, even when you are in a situation where you are about to be operated on. Like, yeah. This person is able to say to the person with all the skill and all the health, look, and he does that, and he has knife in hand. We're so close to each other, we can hurt each other, we can change each other, and we can show each other what we're able to see from our points of view if we'd only dare to demand or ask or offer.
You do include personal anecdotes, almost like diary entries that accompany these poems. It's your own analysis. Why did you want us to see these glimpses of your own life?
Well, I suppose I'm interested in how it is that people can turn to a poem and feel like the poem's in conversation with yourself. So partly by bringing parts of my own life, I want to show here's what you can do, that it isn't just about looking at the technique of metaphor or how many stanzas or whether there is or isn't rhyme or a particular kind of form. It's also about saying, oh, that line makes me think of that thing that happened to me yesterday. One of the poems in the book is a Langston Hughes poem, and I chose that because somebody had written to me a few years ago on Instagram and said that there had been a close friendship that had fallen apart, and was there a poem for her? And so I suppose we're often looking for a small secular liturgy for our lives, and poetry can provide that sometimes.
So, drum roll, let me turn to, you did just publish a collection of your own poetry. It is titled Kitchen Hymns. Congratulations on that.
Thanks very much.
On the jacket, you write that the collection is, and I'm quoting, structured like a ghost mass where God has disappeared, but longing still has things to say.
And I read that and thought, that's absolutely beautiful. And also, I have no idea what it means. What does it mean, Padre Gotumi?
I'm mostly interested in hearing what you don't think it means.
Where God has disappeared, but longing still has things to say. Are you circling us back in a way to that idea of human connection?
Well, I am. And also, I suppose God is just a noise we make to contain something about what it is we long for and our relationship with our longing. I trained in theology. To fixate too much on the word God, I think, is to miss out the fact that prayer arises naturally in the human heart, whether or not anybody has a relationship to formal religion. So a ghost mass for me is using structure and trying to say, you can come here whatever you think about this sound we make with our mouths, God, because there's yearning in the human heart.
There is a whole section of your book where every poem is titled, Do You Believe in God? Why did you set it up that way?
Well, I think that phrase, certainly I came across it in quite an aggressive way, where there used to be evangelical missionaries from the north of Ireland would come to Cork, where I grew up, and would ask everybody, the priest, the nun, people on the way in and out to Mass, do you believe in God? And it felt like a trap, you know, and the question wasn't, do you believe in God? It's, do you believe in God in the proper way as dictated by me? Do you believe in that? And I got to know some of them. They were lovely people. And so I've been interested for a long time in what happens with that question, do you believe in God? And what's it like if the you is structured in a way of profound exchange rather than a trap?
Mm.
I'm less interested in the word believe and much more interested in the word you.
Would you read us out with the one, again, titled, Do You Believe in God? The one that begins, I turn to you.
For sure. Do you believe in God? I turn to you, not because I trust you or believe in you, but because I need a direction for my need. You, the space between me and death. You, the hum at the heart of an atom. You, nothing. You, my favorite emptiness. You, what I turned away from and will turn to. You, my ache made manifest in a dress. You, silent you, what my friends saw as they died. You contain what's not containable. You, shape of my desire.
That is Padraig O'Tuma reading to us from his collection, Kitchen Hymns. He is also editor of the new anthology, 44 Poems on Being with Each Other. Padraig O'Tuma, thank you for a moment of beauty in a chaotic moment.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation.
The only one who knows this ounce of words is just a token is he who has a tongue to tell that must remain unspoken. Thank you.